Welcome to the Board Game Barbecue Podcast. I am your host for this episode, and my name is Mitch, and I am here with two of my bestest friends on the show. First up is Def up in Brisbane. How are you going?
Hello. I'm good, mate. How are you?
Very, very well. And my other co-host for the show is Adrian, also in Brisbane. How are you?
Did you hear that, Connor? Bestest friends. You're out. Yeah, good. How you doing, buddy?
Yeah, not too bad. I hear you guys are just trying to keep your heads above water at the moment.
Yeah, something like that.
Literally.
We've had like 120 mils of rain today. So it's been pretty full on, but
pretty hectic.
The house hasn't moved yet, so
All right. And for those listening, you don't have to just put up with the three of us today because we have a very special guest with us all the way from Arizona in the US. It's game designer Dwayne Wolf. How you doing, Dwayne?
Great. Hello, everybody, and thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Now, probably just to kick things off, Dwayne, tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of your board gaming background, because I know you've just started, you've designed a board game that's been on Kickstarter recently, which we'll touch on in a moment. But in terms of what brought you to that point, where did you start in the hobby and how long have you been interested in board games for?
Well, I've been interested in like over 40 years because I really was into them when I was young. You know, like your regular run-of-the-mill games. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of the highlight, one of my highlights growing up. And I was a 10th child of 11. And, like, I really never spent that much time with my dad. I mean, he was really busy, and I was a 10th kid. So, but what we did do together is play board games every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's something imprinted in me, like, I wanted my dad more, so now I don't know. I've thought about that over the years, but yeah I like, you know, we played, my favorite game was Masterpiece. I don't know if you know that Parker Brothers game from way back in the 70s, but it was an auction game. Right. But then I kind of left board games when I went to college, and I got into cards, and I played cards for many, many years, and eventually found Bridge, and that kind of, you know, beat all the other games I had been playing and played. So I just really fell in love with Bridge. But then I always had board games in my mind, and even though I didn't play them that much, and actually in college I had an idea of designing a game when I first took a population genetics class in graduate school and started learning how, you know, like DNA among animal populations changes over time and forces that affect that, and how selection, you know, whether it's man-made selection or natural selection affects genetic change over time. And I thought that'd be a real cool basis for a board game. So I kind of had, you know, I've had that in my mind for 20 some years, but never did anything about it. And then in 2013, I started thinking a little more seriously. If I'm ever going to publish that, I had, you know, thrown around the mechanics in my brain over the years. I said, if I'm ever going to publish that, I better get to it. So I started, actually I found out about modern board gaming by looking into design. And then I started watching YouTube videos, and then I found Board Game Geek, and I was like, wow, I've been missing out here for the last several years. So I kind of been into modern board games for, I guess, about 10 years.
Yeah, right. So the game that you've recently designed and recently kickstarted is Union Stockyards. For those that might have missed it when it was on Kickstarter, do you want to give us a little bit of a rundown of the game, how it works, and how it plays through?
Yep. So it's the theme. This is it's a historical theme based on the Union Stockyards in Chicago, which during the late 1800s and early 1900s was called the busiest square mile on earth. 40,000 workers worked there, and 1 million animals passed through a month. There was over 2,000 pens and 130 miles of railroad in that one square mile.
Wow.
I mean, it's like a place that never existed and never will exist again. So that theme always interested me, but I also wanted an economic game where supply and demand was central to the game. So it is in this game. See, it revolves around the market. You have cattle, hogs, and sheep, and they each have their own individual market. And the price of livestock goes up and down throughout the game, and that's the same for everybody. But you are playing packers. You're one of the big five packers of the day. So you make money by buying livestock low and selling meat high. That's your goal. But that's not always easy to do. So you're trying to raise your margin. The margins will differ between the players, even though the cost of livestock could be the same. Your value of meat will be different. So you're trying to increase your margin by adding value to the meat, by using different parts of the animal, which was really thematic to the day. They were, instead of wasting things, they were trying to find ways to use all the different parts of the animal. So that's the heart of it, is the economic supply and demand type game. And the way you select your actions is worker placement. So it's just standard worker placement, except your workers can go on strike. That's the unique thing about the worker placement. Is you can have one worker less, which is pretty significant for a round if you have a strike. So that's something you have to manage.
Yeah, right.
I remember the margin, the player margin that you have separately, because obviously, supply and demand determines value of different, commodities or markers in most economic games. But I thought the idea of having on top of that different margin per player, depending on their, individual situation for that specific type of cattle, was a very clever idea. And I don't think I've seen any other games doing that. So I thought it was quite interesting. Did you have any, did you get any inspiration, I guess, from any existing economic games that you've played or you've seen out there, Dwayne?
Oh, yeah. Yep. I tend to like economic games, Euro games, low luck strategy games is kind of my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
I like a wide variety, but those are my favorite. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and then as I was, I tried to even play other games that I hadn't played that had market mechanics in as I was designing this and trying to get other ideas, but probably, the way the market works in Clans of Caledonia influenced it, a lot. And, so that's probably one that had the biggest influence, but Power Grid, there's a lot of games that have market mechanisms, but most of them are not central to the game, except like in Stockpile, that's a game I like, but that the market is central to the game, but it's luck, it's driven by cards and dice and
it's less
I didn't want a luck driven market. So all those things, but it's not really like any of those. And it creates player interaction because, if everybody's going for pigs, you don't want to be in pigs because so you got to kind of read what everyone else is doing and try and do the opposite. So it does create some really cool player interaction.
How's your experience with, kickstarting your first game, obviously, and both from a perspective of, how well the game did against your expectations, but also the whole logistics behind it and how much of an effort it is to actually not just publish the game, but get through that crowdfunding, process.
Yep. So actually this is my second game I've kickstarted. So that animal breeding, the genetics game, was called Pedigree. That was that was the first game I kickstarted in 18. And so that gave me a lot of experience that helped me with this one. That was kind of a niche game. I was targeting a certain niche that would like that theme, where this game I thought could appeal to all Euro gamers and the BGG crowd. So I thought this had a lot bigger audience. So I learned a ton from doing that first game, and that helped me with this game. And then I got more people involved. I had professional marketing and such with this game, which really helped.
Yeah, of course. I didn't realize Pedigree was also crowdfunded. So that's interesting. And have you seen a change in these years between when you did Pedigree and this game, or you think the market has, because obviously since Pedigree was released, I think you mentioned it was 2018, you know, we had COVID in between, which changed the board game market a lot, at least as far as we have seen.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me was just the difference in the appeal of my second game had a lot more appeal than the first game.
And COVID might have been even a benefit for board gaming. So many people locked inside for so long, you know, looking for different things to do.
Yeah, I think I think board game sales were up during COVID. They were up during. I know they were up during COVID. So,
do you think the reason people found your Union Stockyard a more not palatable but a bigger success is because it is like steeped in real history? Because for me personally, I did back the game. Being in Australia, I'd never heard of Union Stockyard, so I think maybe it's just something that I don't know because, you know, we're so far away from it and it's just something that's never been brought up in my life. But after reading about it, I was really fascinated by the building and by all the infrastructure that surrounded it, and I wondered if it was something that's a little bit more well-known in the States, or maybe it's just something that was a big thing and it's almost sort of passed into a bit of a myth sort of slash legend category that it's not known by everybody. So,
yeah. So just talking to random people that I run into, I think it's fairly well known. Most people, the most famous or the reason most people know about it is the book, The Jungle, which was published in 1906, which was by Upton Sinclair. And that was like the bestseller of the day. And it's still read. It was still like a book that's read in high schools and such, assigned as reading material. So a lot of people have read The Jungle, which is kind of about the struggle of an immigrant working in the stockyards. And so that's a lot. But as far as the appeal, I mean, I was like so excited. I mean, it was so exciting to create this game because I think it had a really, I'm really fascinated by the theme, and it's really unique. And it's also, it's the mechanic. I've really wanted to create an economic market manipulation game, and it just fit. The theme and the mechanic just fit together, and for me, it was just a blast.
It's funny, you've kind of preempted one of my questions that I had written down, Dwayne, which was how much emphasis did you want to put onto ensuring that the game mechanics reflected the theme and the history of the time there as well. So yeah, obviously that was a big consideration of yours.
Yeah, I will expand on that though, because that was actually one of the most enjoyable parts of designing this was, so if I couldn't get theme and mechanics to mesh, you know, I would choose a mechanically sound game and compromise theme a little bit, because at the heart, I want it to be a great game, regardless of course, if you pay attention to the theme or not. But when I was looking for those different mechanical components and trying to match a theme, that was just super enjoyable, just trying to rack my brain, trying to figure out how can I make it thematic and keep this cool mechanic at the same time, or find the perfect mechanic that is thematic, but yet a fun mechanic, even if you ignore the theme. That was like, that's what I really like about game design, is searching for that, like just searching for that and trying different games and reading rule books, playing games. You know, I watch review videos just to figure out getting exposed to as many games as I can, even if I don't have time to play them all. And then just coming up with unique ideas that aren't in any other games, just trying to rack your brain. That's super enjoyable to me.
And you've obviously got to a point now where you're moving along the process of the probably finalizing the design, I'll assume, or if it's not already finalized and production. That said, knowing how long these games take to develop, have you got anything else in the pipeline that you're working on? Has it motivated you to start looking into other things to design, or are you happy where you are at the moment?
Oh no, I'm holding myself back because I want to make sure I don't compromise this one. But yes, I got several others in there.
Excellent. So stuff to keep an eye out for us then.
Yep.
For sure. I guess with that as well, I would ask a question, how do you find time for it? Because I've done a little bit of research on yourself, Dwayne, and I see that you're actually a professor at the Arizona University College, I believe, and highly decorated. You've been recognized a number of times for your work in the animal sciences area and statistics. And from what I could tell, specifically pertaining to meat, by all means, correct me if I mess any of that up. But a little bit off topic from board games, what's your favorite meat to barbecue?
Oh, that's like asking me who's my favorite person. They're all good. Depends on the day. So, yeah, I really like a ribeye. Mostly beef would be my favorite. Mm-hmm. Would be my favorite meat probably, but, you know, I really like a tri-tip and a ribeye steak and a hanger steak, which is the part of the diaphragm.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I've ever had that.
I don't know what they're all called or not. They're, you know, every country has different names. I don't know if these names mean anything in Australia.
Yeah. Have you ever tried kangaroo?
No, I haven't.
Well, there you go. You can put that on your list.
Yeah. No, I'd really like to visit Australia.
Yeah.
That's on my list.
It's a very, kangaroo is a very, very lean meat. A lot of people who are training and trying to stay away from high fats and things will go towards a kangaroo because it is very, very lean, but it's very rich as well.
I've only ever had it once and I really liked it. I thought it was really nice. I never buy it though. Do you know what I mean? It's a strange thing. I should probably try and buy it more.
Is it just like for sale in the supermarket?
Pretty much. I mean, it's not as common as like your beefs and your porks and things like that. But if you look, most supermarkets will carry a couple of cuts, I think, these days. Yeah. There's a bit of a debate going on at the moment because I don't think anyone actually farms kangaroo because there's something like 10 kangaroos for every person, head of population in the country. Like it's ridiculous. They're just everywhere. When you get out west, once you get out of the cities and things,
we have to get the numbers down.
So that's the thing. There's a bit of a battle between the conservationists and the meat eaters.
Yeah, well, we have to keep the population in control somehow, right?
Indeed, and they do interfere a lot with the farmers and their crops and things. So you get a lot of them; they can wipe almost a whole crop out. And they can jump fences and things too, so it doesn't really help.
I actually had one when it was only a small one. It was only like a tiny kangaroo. It wasn't very big, maybe, 600, 700 mil high. And I thought, he's stuck in the garden. Like he can't get out. He can't get over that fence. So I kind of stupidly walked over there to try and assist him towards the gate. And this thing jumped this fence like it was nothing. It just stood still and went bounce and just jumped this like a meter and a half high fence, almost twice his height, and it was gone. And it was like I couldn't believe how much they could jump for such a small animal.
Easily, they do.
Yeah, easily. Just he didn't even think about it. Yeah. I thought this is going to be a mission to get this thing out of my garden, but he just went boink. He was off. So it was pretty cool.
If only we could train him to play basketball. All right. Well, we might actually then talk or move on to our next little discussion that we generally have on every episode where we talk about games that we've been playing lately. So thanks for answering those questions, Dwayne. And if you'd like to hang around, we'd love to have you for the rest of the show.
You bet.
All righty. So we'll start with you, Def. What's been hitting your table lately?
So I know you've been looking forward to to doing this, Mitch, because I just finished my first game of Fire in the Lake, which is the fourth volume, I think, of the Coin series by GMT. And I've spoken about some of the Coin games before and how fascinated I've been since I discovered them. But, this was a whole different level. My brain is still steaming. So Fire in the Lake, for those that don't know, is a historic, I guess, game about the conflict in Vietnam, and typically we get a counterinsurgent and insurgent faction. So you've got the U.S. and you've got the North Vietnam and the Viet Cong, and Republic of Vietnam, which represents the second counterinsurgent faction in the game. And yeah, it's been quite a mission to try and go get through the game, but I'm so glad I did, because it's absolutely fascinating in all of these games that combine the historic elements with very well thought mechanics. You know, fascinating. It's even like almost like you're playing the game, but you're almost not playing. You're kind of sort of sitting there watching the whole thing unfold. Almost. And I know that you've had it on your table for the last few days, and
I have, yes. So I think my photos of the setup when I decided to have a go and get it out was what inspired you to get it out.
It was.
You just beat me to the punch, because I was actually sitting here last night and turned over the first event card, which was it's called the Burning Bronze. I think everyone's familiar with the photo that was sort of at the time very popular, yes, with the monk that burned himself in protest. And it got me to thinking, because I was like, I don't really know a lot about this conflict, like not as much as I should. And I was questioning why was the Americans allying with the government who was causing monks to protest in the street and burn themselves alive? Like, that's pretty serious, right? So before I'd even played my first turn, I went, I've got to find out about this. I need to know what the truth is, what happened historically. And I went and read about that monk and what he'd done and the reasons for it, and learned that the South Vietnamese government were actually persecuting the Buddhists back then. And that led me to read another article about the war and so on, and it just became this knock-on effect that I just got so deep into reading about the history, and I spent about an hour to an hour and a half just reading about the Vietnam War to start to finish, and how it happened, and all the different sides that were involved, and the struggles that the US had, and why they were there, and obviously they had a number of presidential changes whilst it was going on. Yeah. Because from Kennedy then through all the way to, I think it was Nixon at the end. And an hour and a half later, I hadn't played a turn because I spent all my time reading about, what was going on, and just getting, really getting to the, and to this morning, I still haven't played my first turn because, after an hour and a half of reading about the war, I was like, I need a break. And I remembered that the Spurs had played yesterday. So I went and watched the Spurs game. And haven't got back to it yet, but that's where you and I guess differ a little bit, Def. I'm quite happy to just have it set up, play a turn maybe, then come back to it a little bit later, whereas in the time I'll take to play two turns, you'll have played it six times.
Yeah, it's fascinating though, isn't it? Because this is what these games, where they shine. They get you into these historic periods and get you to, get you curious about them and learn more. I mean, I'm not going to forget the first coin game I played was Old Bridges Burning, which was about the Finnish Civil War in 1914. Like, I knew nothing about this. I didn't even know there was a civil war in Finland at that period of time or at all. So, and yet they have their way of getting you into the theme and learning. You learn so much about them. And the mechanics are so well, tied into these games that you can't help it. Like, I'm absolutely fascinated by these types of games. And, the entry level is quite high, and, they're quite difficult games to sort of get on the table. But I'm sure you would agree that the core mechanics, the core system is, as soon as you get your head around it, you can play pretty much any one of these games without much effort.
Yeah, and I think that you're right. The games aren't going to be for everybody, but I think when you do delve into the history and you understand, what's been the motivation for the game from that historical context, it's not just about playing a fun game. It's about it's such a richer experience because you get all that knowledge and understanding, and you fully experience it as an event, as opposed to just, like simply playing a game. And I get, and I know that's not going to be for everyone, but I think it just adds so much more to the experience when you have that behind it as well.
Have you tried any of these coin games, Dwayne?
The coin games? I have not tried the coin games. No, I have studied a lot of the Vietnam War. I actually took a class on it.
Okay.
And just watched the Ken Burns documentary, which is about 14 hours long. It's
wow,
a fascinating piece of history. Like you said, the presidents that there were several presidential changes. And unfortunately, that led to that caused a lot of the they like to keep the war going to get reelected. And that was part of the unfortunate parts of that war.
Yeah. And even, you know, I never understood or realized that, you know, there were influences from the war, the Korean War and the Bay of Pigs in Cuba that they saw as, you know, failures, I guess, or not successes at least, that the US had had. And then, and a lot of the factors at the, at least at the start of the Vietnam War was not wanting to have a third where they had participated in, you know, offshore relations where that, you know, didn't go so well. So yeah, it's just, yeah, it did open my eyes up a lot to the intricacies of how it all unfolded that I just never had any understanding of. And that's all come out of board games.
Yeah.
So have you played, Root, Dwayne, at all?
Yeah, actually my family, my sons and I play that a lot. It's one of our favorite games to play together. So is that similar to the coin system?
Yeah. So I think when we had, Cole Worley on the show, he actually mentioned that he drew a lot of his inspiration from the coin series.
Yeah.
In the sense that you've got, like, in the coin games, you've got different factions, and each of the different factions will have a different win condition. They also each have different operations as to how they play. So you're kind of playing four different games at the same time, just like you are in Root. The difference being that Root's probably a little bit more sort of less of an entry barrier because it's cutesy little animals and you're running in the forest and you know, you're doing things like that, as opposed to, you know, running the drug cartel for the Colombian mafia and whatever you would be doing in the Andean Abyss. So, but ultimately, yeah, I see a lot of similarities in terms of the gameplay and the way that works. But as you can imagine, if you're a good, the government trying to put down an insurgency, the way you're doing that is going to be very different to a drug cartel who's trying to sneak around underneath the government, you know,
and make
produce drugs and,
whatever,
and make money.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you got different win conditions, different strategies, different motivations. But, yeah, they're really, really good. And it sounds like, you know, with your game, Union Stockyard's very, very steeped in history and what went on there. You might enjoy that same sort of link to the historical aspects and the events that happened in those things throughout history as well.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I really like history. I didn't when I was young, but I'm really fascinated now. Root plays best at like three or four, but the coin games, they work well solo. Is that correct?
You can play them solo. But they're designed to work usually with four. Def's probably a bit more versed with most of them than I am. I've played, I think, three of them now.
Yeah, so they all work with four players, apart from All Bridges Burning, which is built with three factions, so it's only up to a three-player game, and Colonial Twilight, which is about the French-Algerian War, which is a two-player game. All the rest are four players. But, they all have AIs that you can use for some of the or any of the factions if you're playing with less than four players in solo as well. And you know, they're high maintenance because you have to go through flowcharts or cards to identify what they will do each turn, but they play exactly like a human would. So they simulate, you know, the multiplayer game pretty well. But like I said before, I think for me it's so far, I've played most of my plays with all the coin games, just playing all factions at the same time, because it just fascinates me watching things unfold. And the games are so thematic that sometimes you feel like some of the actions, like they go out of your control even. And it's funny because you're playing all four factions and you go, surely this will go on until the end because nobody's going to be able to win. I'm playing all factions. And yet, at some point, one faction might run away with the win, even if you try to stop them yourself, which is pretty funny saying it, but it's actually quite fascinating watching it. So, yeah, the system is fantastic, and once you get your head around it, it's very easy to adapt it to any of the games. And that's the main thing. You learn one of these, you can play all of them with small variations or a couple of new things that they have in them. So,
and I was just saying to Def this morning, actually, that I think the Fire in the Lake would play really well as a two-player game because the Viet Cong and the NVA have very similar motivations. So one player can play the Viet Cong and the NVA while the other player plays the US and the ARVN together. So I think there's even, and as I said, I've learned this from the rule book because I haven't actually played my first turn yet, but Def, you could confirm, there's even the ability in this game, say, for example, the US can spend resources of the ARVN.
Yeah, so they share resources, and there's this delicate balance between an economic, I guess, marker which sits somewhere on, you know, on the victory point track, and anything above that, the US can spend as if it was their own resource. But once it reaches that marker, it's like the RVN's own resources, and the US cannot tap into that. But there's ways to manipulate those markers up and down depending on the operations and the way that the U.S. politics sort of influence what's going on in southern Vietnam. So, yeah, like you said, Mitch, they have a lot of common goals. And in a two-player game, you would probably play the two insurgent factions and the second player would play the two coin factions. So I haven't seen that in the other games. I mean, there's usually some synergies, but not as much as in this one. But yeah, it's been a pretty awesome experience for sure.
And as much as I'd like to talk about coin games for the next hour and a half, probably the rest of the day, we'd best talk about something else. So we'll throw over to Adrian now, and you can let us know what you've been getting into the last couple of days.
I have been playing lots of different games, actually, all sorts, from smaller, lighter games. With Finn this morning, we played Dinosaur Island Roll and Write, which is a game we haven't played for ages. But, man, it's still great. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's still just a really solid roll and write. And I think there's a huge appeal to, like, for Finn, his age, because, like, you know, he's seven, and he knows some of the games and some of the mechanics, but just those massive dice that he gets to roll, they're so big and so chunky and so colorful. Mm. And it's really interesting now, you know, because when we played it before, you'd have to coach him through quite a lot because obviously it's not super heavy, but it's not the lightest of the roll and write genre games. And now that he's a little bit older, and now that he's coming back to it, after playing it three or four times previously and then having, you know, 6 months away from it, then playing it again, it was only a couple of turns in till he was back in the flow of it and knew what he was doing. So that was really cool. And he did really well, actually. He did much better than I did. But, yeah, it was interesting for sure.
And I noticed you put up a photo of MJ had been –
that
building
was me.
Her dinosaur park with all attractions. And oh, that was you.
That was me. Yeah.
All attractions and no dinosaurs in your dinosaur park.
Yeah, well, there's that line in Jurassic Park where I can't remember the guy's name, but it's played by the guy who was in The Fly, Jeff Goldblum. And he says, hello, and he like taps the monitor. He's like, is there going to be any dinosaurs in this dinosaur tour ride? Well, on my dinosaur tour ride, I had no dinosaurs until like the third round. So through the whole game, there was no dinosaurs. It was all just merch shops and just a bunch of junk. But yeah, it's still a fun game. We
and
really
roller coasters.
Yeah, roller coasters and merch shops for the dinosaur park. But it was good fun. We really enjoyed it. But I have been, well, this is a spoiler for my Oath, and I think everyone knows it's coming because they would have seen photos on socials and stuff. But I got to play Pampero a couple of times at PAX, which was just such a good game. Like, I really enjoyed it. And it's kind of cool seeing reviews and stuff come out for this game that, you know, I've been playtesting for a long time. And to see a lot of reviewers really enjoy the game, like genuinely enjoying the game and enjoying the mechanics behind it and where the mechanics meet the theme. And I really enjoy those games. Like for me, abstract, I don't really play any abstract games. Like I don't even think you could name an abstract game that I'd ever sizzled, to be honest. They're just not my thing. But I really enjoy it where theme meets the mechanics. And I really feel that with Pampero. I think that's a really good blend of those. And it's now on Kickstarter. It's fulfilled. It's doing really well. There's a lot of people as well that I see because they've got a crazy deal on where it's like $16 to ship it like to the Oz. But if you buy eight copies, shipping's been it's still good. $16. So there's lots of people that are jumping in these group pledges. So even though, you know, that it might only say 1,000 backers or 1,200 backers, there's some people, some of these groups, I've seen the Brisbane one, there's like 9 copies getting bought by that one group. So there's it's a much bigger, I don't know what that's called, but you see that number, but the number's actually a lot bigger in reality because in the late pledge, people are adding multiple copies to it. Have you seen or heard of Pampero, Dwayne?
Yes. Yeah, I'm a backer.
Nice.
And I've read reviews and watched reviews. One thing I haven't figured, and I've read part of the rules, but my question for you, since you've played it, that I've been wondering and haven't been completely been able to figure out from the reviews is how would you rate the weight of it?
Right.
Like the like it's not a Vital, right? Lacerda. It's not as heavy as a Lacerda. Is that correct?
Julian, the designer, actually he was the developer for Vital for a lot of his early games and still did solo modes and stuff for some of the other games. And I think believe still does work with Vital. It has very strong. A lot of people have compared it and said, oh, it's like a Vital game. Like it feels like a Vital game. And it really does. It does have that complexity in it. Also, the scoring conditions that you're playing with in the base game and what most of the reviewers have shown, they are like the entry level, if you know what I mean. They are like the basic
the scoring conditions, ones.
The simple ones. There are other ones in there which are really quite complex and really quite interesting that haven't even really been touched on in any reviews, but that power grid that you have, that player board, it has these little symbols on it, little triangles, little squares, little I think stars or hexes or something, maybe square, circle, triangle, and those all link together, and depending on how many of those links you can create within your own power grid is how many points you get, and those are really quite intricate and hard to sort of map out. Yeah, I'd say it would be like a 4. If I had to give a number to it, like I would say 4.
What are some games you would compare it to as far as weight? Not necessarily how they play, but just the weight.
Yeah, I'd say like Barrage. Like Barrage-y kind of weight, base game, Barrage maybe. Like Teotihuacan.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Like it's a little bit heavier than Teo, but I think that's more in the interaction with the players. Because you can really interact with each other by, you know, fulfilling contracts with other people's towers and paying them rather than paying the bank. Because you've used, you know, they've kind of subcontracted that work out to you and you've done it through their system. So you have to pay them as opposed to putting the money back in the supply. But yeah, it when we played it at PAX and we had it at PAX, it got a lot of attention. Like a lot of heavy Euro gamers were coming up and not even knowing about the game necessarily. And they would say, what is this game? Like, because they could tell there's a lot going on. And yeah, you'd give them the talk and tell them what it was and where it was going to. And yeah, people were very, very interested in it. But it's a fantastic game. It's a great blend of theme and mechanics. It's an energy game. And I just really dig those energy games for some reason. That mix of kind of economics and energy. I just like it. Some reason it seems to be my thing, but yeah, it's
are you great. Back in this one, Dev?
Yeah,
because I'm on the fence, to be honest, still, because I'm like, oh, I don't know. Well, but then hearing Adrian say that the base game has some, you know, sort of easier sort of goals and objectives and things, and you can ramp it up as you go if you want to, that might be more appealing to more people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on, but I think Adrian, I think, is on the money when he says it's on par with Barrage base game in terms of complexity. I was thinking more like CO2 Second Chance, which I think has a, you know, kind of similar theme around energy as well, but maybe somewhere in between those two. No, it's a great game. We've played it probably a couple of weeks ago, and I had a really good experience with it. I'm expecting it will be quite the success when it gets released wider as well. Well, I'm hoping at least, because I think Julian's got a lot of additional designs to offer in the market. So pretty happy with it. So glad it's doing well.
Yeah, I'm with you. I like thematic games. I like when the mechanics are tied into that, and that the theme was intriguing to me. But it just looked like the mechanics all meshed together. I really like that when you can use other people's things and they benefit from it, like the bulldozer aspect of the game. That really, I like games like that. Just several different things. So looking at the rule, I mean, there's only like a few actions you can do, it seems like to me. That's where I don't understand where the complexity is coming from, because it's just the brief overview. I haven't played it, but you have, and that's why I asked you the question. Because just looking at the rules and the overview, it seems like it's fairly straightforward.
I find sometimes with Vital games, and I'm not a huge, as big a Eurogamer as these other two guys, but I find that when I sit down and learn, like even Kanban EV, for example, there's only, four or five different actions that you can take in Kanban, but it's not necessarily about the number of actions as opposed to how efficient you can be in sequencing those actions and ensuring that you have a plan that works together. I remember when I played with Def and his wife, Dimmy, I would, produce cars off the factory line, and Dimmy would go and steal them right out from underneath me, because she had a better system in place. And I'm like, you can't keep doing that to me. And she's like, I can, as long as you're going to choose the actions in the wrong order, I'll be doing that all night. I don't know if Pompero is the same, but I know that the few actions sometimes is a bit deceptive for those of us who aren't that great at those big games.
It's also the tension of putting the cards in and locking them in into that action board, and then almost having them stuck there at the far left, and you can only take that one back from the far right at the end of the round. So you might have a card that's three cards in that you want back for the next round, but to get that back, you need to kind of rest, if you will, to then draw back all your cards, and that's a wasted turn. And anyone that plays a Euro game knows they don't want to do that. They want to try and keep playing and keep the engine going, not have to almost forego a turn to get your cards back. So manipulating where your dozer is and what column you have your action card sitting in, also which one sits at the far end of the turn by the end of the round, is really, really important. And that changes constantly from game to game because of the scoring conditions change, the bonuses that you get will change. Other players will use your dozer and move it somewhere else that you don't necessarily want it to be, and that will change. It's got that really interesting blend of your own personal tension, because you're constantly trying to keep an eye where your cards are and what you're doing. Also, other players using your stuff that you don't want them to use, even though you can use their stuff and that's fine. And it might even be more beneficial to you. You might look at it and go, hang on a second, they've moved my dozer to here, but their dozer's there and I'm going to do this. And that's actually a better action for me anyway. But then you might look and go, oh crap, I haven't got the card that does that. Now what do I do? Like, I'm stuck. So you have this kind of strange interaction with yourself and with the other players. And yeah, it's fantastic. I've talked about this game for like over a year. And like I said in the Discord to Harry today, there's a reason why I put this game in my top 10 games, with only playing it as clip art, like not the proper final art and final version. It's a fantastic game. It's got a lot of depth to it, especially with all the different multiple avenues to victory and the interaction between each player. Yeah, I think it's great. So I'm sure I'll be talking about it again in the future.
Yeah.
It's a great game.
So since you have been talking about the game for a year, I'm going to stop you from talking about it right now.
You always do that. You have a record. You have a record of stopping me talking about anything alike. You're like, no Kingdom Death Monster anymore, no Pipeline, no Barrage, no Pampero, nothing. Like, I'm not allowed anything.
You're out. I'm in the host chair today, so you just have to say, suck it up. And I'm going to move on to what I've been playing lately, which is a bit of a new hotness. It's sort of just started fulfilling around the world from Kickstarter. I've actually played it the last two weekends in a row. I've been invited to two separate game days, and that is Endless Winter by Final Frontier Games.
Tell me more.
So Endless Winter, it's not as heavy as the games previously discussed, Pampero and so forth. And I've heard people compare it to Dune Imperium and Lost Ruins of Arnak, but I don't see it. I mean, there's similarity, sure. They all use cards, but that's about where it ends. And there's a little bit of deck building. Yeah. It's a board game. I guess they've got that in common. But yeah, I don't really see any great similarities between Dune Imperium, Arnak, and Endless Winter. But let me do a quick overview of the game and how it plays. So ultimately, you are playing a tribe of Paleo-Americans. You're trying to build up your tribe and be as successful as you can. Game-wise, you're trying to achieve the most victory points by the end of the game. You do this by... it's a mix of Dex Builder and Worker Placement, which I guess is another similarity between Dune and Endless Winter. You have a starting deck of cards. The cards are usually multi-use, and this is where it's a fascinating sort of decision space for me, because you have cards that you can play during your turn for the actions that they have on them, or also Effort, which is another symbol on the card. Which is like a resource in the game that you have to spend in order to do certain actions. So an action may require you to discard a certain number of cards just for their effort. You also then have a phase. So the first phase is essentially your worker placement phase, where you're going out and you're doing certain different things. There's a mechanic in there that if you choose particular worker places first, you get a bonus for being the first one to choose that section. Then the second phase is... an eclipse phase, where you throughout your turns you can choose to dedicate cards and towards the eclipse phase. Now, the eclipse phase at its heart is essentially just a little process to determine who's going to be the first player in the next round. And I know there are a lot of games that will do that in terms of changing the player order, but I think Endless Winter does it really, really well, because there are also benefits that go along with being the first player. So there's a small table, which is where the player orders is worked out. But if you're the first person in the eclipse phase, if you win, in inverted commas, that eclipse phase, then you receive the ability to place a megalith, or you can choose any of the other resources that are on offer as well. So being first not only gets you the ability to be the first person in the next round and take your turns first, but it also gives you that massive benefit of being able to place a megalith for free, which is essentially an action in the game that is fairly rare. You don't get to do them all that often. So not only winning that eclipse phase is not necessarily so much as being first in turn order, but also being able to get those resources. So it does become this trade-off between, do I send cards to the eclipse phase so that I can win that eclipse phase, or do I use them now during my rounds so that I have a more efficient and more successful round? So there's that playoff. And then within that, there's then so many different places going on where you can score points. It's very pointsality. You've got card collections of animals. You can collect animal cards in sets and you get points from that. You can build the megaliths, as I've just spoken about, which is essentially placing tiles onto a board, which will get you little bonuses. And then if you build certain little structures on that board, you get bonus points for that. They have tracks. I can't remember what the names of the tracks are off the top of my head.
Idle tracks.
Two tracks that you can advance your idle tracks up. Yep, the idles. They will score you more points for buried cards. So a buried card, for those who understand what deck builders are, buried cards is effectively the way that you thin out your deck. So you remove maybe the cards you don't want to keep in your deck and are not as good as other ones. But the more of those berry cards will score you more points, providing you've moved up this track. The higher you get on the track, the more benefits you get out of your buried card. So actually thinning your deck becomes a strategy to score points. Then you have this terrain map area where you're also placing camps and villages out on to benefit from the resources that come out of each of those different type of land areas and terrain areas. So there's so much going on, and you might sort of think, oh man, there's so much going on in this game, it's all over the place. But it's not. It's really not. It's not super hard. And I said to Harry that I was playing yesterday, I don't typically enjoy really, really tight games. I know Adrian does. I know Sarah loves them when the economy is really tight and there's not a lot of money going around. This game doesn't feel tight because there's always something you can do. You can always use your resources in some way. And it doesn't feel punishing and restrictive if you make a bad decision. You may not score as many points as I found out by coming dead last yesterday, but you can still enjoy the time you're spending making those moves. You know, when I say I don't enjoy tight games, I don't enjoy games that feel like if I made a bad decision, then my next three turns are terrible because I don't have enough money to do anything. I'm sort of forced in one direction because I've made a bad decision and now I don't have any resources to recover from that. This game rewards good decisions and will punish bad decisions, but it doesn't stop you from enjoying your game while you're doing it. And I think that ticks all the boxes for me. I'm really, really enjoying it. I think it's a game that will just fly at game days. I think it's, for what it looks like on the table, it looks like, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to learn this, but I've played it twice. I can set it up and teach it now without the rule book.
On that note, like, we played it, and when we read through the rules, it was pretty decent rules, to be honest. The rule book was really good. And then as soon as we started, we just had the back for the iconography thing. After we finished the first game, I was like, I could teach this tomorrow. Like, no problem. It's a really easy game to understand and take the actions. But a lot of those games, it's really easy to do that, but it's really hard to do well at it. So our game that we first played had 3 victory points between the winner and last place, which was me. Have you found the game's quite tight, like in victory points? Or have you just been like way at the back, Mitch, once way in front of you?
Well, the first one I actually won, which was a surprise. But only by, I think, 3 points to Julian. I remember Julian, you know, oh, did I add this? He was going to the board. Did we remember to add this? Did I remember to add that? Because I was trying to squeak out the last few points to try and get in front of me. So, yeah, I think that game was quite tight. And then the game yesterday, I think Kerry won just ahead of Sarah. Harry and I were quite the ways back.
Fair play.
But that sort of fits in with my MO, right? That's generally where I am.
Have you seen this game, Dwayne?
Yeah, I've seen it. I have not played it.
Okay.
I played other games by that designer, but I have not played Endless Winter.
Mm.
I just got his new game this week, Resurgence. Have you heard of that game?
No.
After a nuclear destruction.
Yeah, right.
how do you say that word? In Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a combination of bag building and worker placement. So I'm excited to play that one.
Yeah. That's Stan Kordonsky, is it? Something like that?
Yeah. That's it. I have to say massive thanks, appreciation to the Miko, because I think this is hands down his best art ever. Like, I don't know why. It just feels really grounded. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what it is. It looks really realistic. I know that he does it already. Every person that he draws kind of has a bit of a character and a background without having any text at all. But I feel like this one is a more realistic implementation of that, if you know what I mean. Like, there's no kind of, I don't know, like super disproportional people. I feel that like this is a real world and this is an amazingly, like, just looks fantastic is what I'm getting at. Like, the cards are really cool. The box art is phenomenal. I feel like it's my favorite of his drawings and his design.
How about you, Def? I think you decided to not back this one, didn't you?
I did not back it. I think I've regretted it a bit. But what I wanted to ask you, Mitch, is I've seen people receiving their games, and there seems to be like a main game and then 67 additional boxes with add-ons and expansions and whatever else. So I'm trying to figure out if, you know, it's a far more involved, complex game that has been sliced and diced to make it more, you know, approachable. Or, you know, have they just created a framework where they can actually plug and play a lot of expansions and the game just, you know, expands its scope?
I think it's option two, to be honest. There's a couple of little sort of mini expansions or variations in the base game that are really easy to plug in. I plug them in straight away, which is the there's glacier bonuses. So typically in the terrain board, if you have a glacier tile, it essentially gets you nothing, but this just adds a little thing on there to get glaciers out of it. And then you have cards that you can just swap out for. Like there's a series of like market cards that are available in every game. The base game have a set, and then there's a, you know, additional ones that come with each of the expansions. It's like if you want to play this expansion, replace this game in the base market with this, you know, with this set of cards, with this set of cards, that are just variations of what they give you when you select those cards and the actions that are available. Yesterday we played with the Rivers and Rafts expansion, which puts a river right the way through the terrain board, and it gives each team or each tribe a canoe that you then can travel down the river with. And there's different bonuses you can pick up from fishing on the river, and it changes slightly the dynamics of where you're placing your tents, your camps, and your villages. I'm not sure. Like it changed the game a little bit. There's a little bit more to take into account, and there's different ways that you can then utilize the whole landscape board. But I'm not sure if it took away just as much as it added, if that makes sense. When I played without the Rivers and Rafts, it felt like there were more landscape tiles available to go to get, you know, to get resources from and to be able to, you know, spread your camps out. Whereas even though you got bonuses off the river and you could do the fishing and they give you the different things as well, it took away some of that landscape that I couldn't then utilize for other bonuses. So the jury's still out on that one. It was fun. It was enjoyable, but I'm not sure if I would include it in every game that I played. Yeah. So, and the others I'm yet to try. There's one called Cave Paintings, which I find really bizarre because you're playing this kind of deck buildery, worker placement, sort of resource management game. And then the cave painting bit adds in a whiteboard marker and a dry erase board where you have to then start circling things and drawing in, you know, your cave paintings onto the walls to get bonuses from. So it's kind of a little bit of out of left field for what the game already is.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see how that fits in and plays with the game as well.
Dwayne, do you have an opinion on those kinds of debates around, you know, having a game that is, I guess, whole from the start and, you know, is seen as a one design from start to end? Or do you also like, you know, these sort of expandable games in a way, either by, you know, expanding their scope or adding more things into them as time goes by? Obviously, you know, a lot of that is done for commercial purposes, but it looks like there's, you know, two ways that designers do it. One is either the game is complex from the start and, you know, they decide, or the publisher decides to strip it down a little bit to make it easier for people to play it and then expand on it its full scope, or, you know, there is one design at the start and then, you know, there's potential for more, so they develop more things. Do you have a preference for those kinds of designs? Like,
well, I have a preference against expansions that were just seemed like a money grab and didn't improve the game. But the other types of expansions, whether they add complexity, you know, I think I like those. If you played a game so much and you're just, you know, it's just, you're ready for something new and you're ready for something a little more advanced, I like those expansions that add a little more complexity for those players that they really love this game, but they just, you know, they played it so much, and that's probably my favorite type of expansion. And then,
yeah, for sure.
There's also expansions that address, you know, issues. As much playtesting as you do, you're still going to have 1,000 times more playtesting in the first few months of that it's on the market. And there's, of course, there's several expansions to games that have kind of addressed or rebalanced or something. And those are kind of like essential expansions.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm of the same opinion. I quite like when the game, I know where it starts and finishes. So Vital's games are a good example of this. And it's interesting because we have this culture now where games are crowdfunding and people kind of expect stretch goals and additional things and all that. And then, you know, Eagle Griffin comes up and says, hey, this is Weather Machine. This is the game. There's not going to be any stretch goals. Take it or leave it. Yeah. I love that because I want to know what the proposition is from the start, right? I want to know that the game is designed from the start to be what it is and not just adding things for, you know.
Yeah. And that's purpose. What I did with Union Stockyards. So I had no stretch goals and this is it. You're getting everything deluxe, and deluxe as we think it should be. And I don't have any ideas for expansions. Even people have asked about expansions, and I've thought a lot. And at this point, I have, you know, I created the game that I thought was complete.
Yeah.
But yeah. Maybe there'll be an expansion someday, but I don't know what it is yet.
Kangaroo meat.
Kangaroo meat.
I don't think they have any kangaroos in the Union Stockyard. Yeah, maybe not.
You need Stockyard 2044.
I mean, thematically, I can think of expansions, but.
All right. So, well, I think that's a good discussion that we've had today there about some games. And I think on that note, we'll move on to our next segment, Question of the Pod.
Hey, guys. Sorry to interrupt this podcast, but it's Mike, Jules, and Connor here to talk to you about Advent Games.
Dean and his team are amazing. They've got an incredible website, adventgames.com.au, which is heavily curated into categories.
And when you bundle up all the games in your cart, don't worry, there's flat rate shipping. If you live in the Sydney metro area, it's $10 and $15 anywhere else in Australia.
And Dean and his team are big supporters of our Sydney Game Day, so make sure you come along to our Sydney Game Days and say g'day to Dean in person.
So head on over to adventgames.com.au and check out all the stuff that's available there.
All right. So the question of the pod from last week was, who have you met through board gaming? So I know I was actually on that pod, so I already talked a bit about who I had met. Def, any honourable mentions or interesting people you've met through board gaming?
Just you two Muppets and the rest of the barbecue crew. I mean, that's been almost on a life-changing level for me, because we started this thing within the middle of COVID, and it grew to become something a lot more than just a podcast for us, with the community around. And now I've got something I never thought I would, you know. I've got groups that I can meet with people, and some of them are good friends now. So many people that leaving someone out would be almost unfair, but I think, you know, definitely the members of our team would be on the top of that list.
Yeah, fair enough. And how about you, Dwayne? Any standouts of people you've met through board gaming?
I would answer this. I mean, I've met, you know, some of the top designers, but I think the biggest thing is that, you know, the friends that I've made. Mm. Like, we moved to this town, Tucson, Arizona, just a couple years ago, and now I know people all over the city through board gaming.
Yeah, right.
And that's how I met them, and that's some of my closest acquaintances are people that I met through board gaming. I mean, I didn't know hardly anybody when I moved to this town.
Yeah, yeah, it's so good. It's good to bring people together like that, for sure. And what about you, Adrian? I know. People wish they'd never met you in board gaming, but
then there is that.
There is definitely that. Half of Brisbane say that. I have to say, it's the same as Dwayne. Like, I moved here from a different country. I didn't know many people living in Australia. Do you know what I mean? Up my life, moved here, And yeah, I didn't know anybody. And everyone that I do know now, apart from my work colleagues, I know through board gaming. I play board games with them. I hang out with them. Some are very good friends. Obviously, you guys as well. You know, we've just met Dwayne here today through board gaming. Like, this is, you know, people that we meet, and, you know, the community's been fantastic. And I'm the same as Def. I couldn't mention any one person because I would have to mention a list of like 300 people and I would never remember everybody. But yeah, I think that it just shows how inclusive the hobby is. I think that's how I feel. I feel that like it's definitely, yeah, super inclusive. Everyone's really nice and we're really lucky that everyone is so awesome. So,
Well, Def, did you want to, I think you were checking out some of the comments we had on Facebook. Did you see any interesting ones?
Yeah, Mark from another podcast, the Diceman Kampf, said that obviously like me or like us, they met through board games, so they created the podcast and met the other Diceman through that. Liam from our community said, and I quote here, "I met this random guy called Adrian Smith." No, he's saying that Adrian's become a good friend of his now and introduced him to so many other new friends in the hobby as well. And, Keith from our Facebook community also said that, like, you know, echoed our views basically, that pretty much everyone he knows he has met through board games. So it's been interesting to see all the comments for this question because it was almost an outpour of responses and yet there's so much common in all of these responses. Yeah. They all talk about, you know, inclusivity and how welcoming the community and the people in this hobby are. So
yeah, what and about their lists will be too long to list. They all say that same sort of thing. You know, so many people that they couldn't list them all. But yeah, we had some on Discord. I had Manny who was saying that he has a gaming crew that met about 10 years ago. Just were people that wanted to play games in the inner west of Sydney, and they're still together meeting to this day. We had Fusel said they met their current partner via online gaming. So that's a bit of a romance story there. So that's a good one, bring people like that. And an interesting one that I thought was that our good friend Kenny, designer of Scrap, said he met his stepdad in a game store. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I would have thought his mum would have introduced him to his stepdad, rather than have to meet him in a game store. But there you go. Actually, I think that was before he became your stepdad, but that wasn't as good a joke. So there you have it. So wrapping up the question of the pod from last week means we have to have a new question of the pod for this week. And we thought one that would be good to go with would be, what is your favorite unique theme or setting? So just to clarify, we're talking about unique themes. So that rules out Vikings. That rules out the zombies. That rules out fantasy. We don't want to hear anyone come back with those ones that are not unique. That rules out superheroes.
I put $1,000 on it right now that JB writes Gloomhaven. Just because you've said that and he loves Gloomhaven that much. He's going to do it. He's just going to say Gloomhaven and you're going to be like, dope.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, I'm going to jump in with the first offer of a unique theme that I enjoy and that I wasn't necessarily expecting to. You may or may not be aware that I like this little game called Fleet the Dice Game, which is about trawling for fish and catching fish and cashing in and selling fish on the dock. So that's my one. I enjoy it. I think it's fantastic. And I actually just picked up a copy of Fleet the Card Game, which was the original inspiration for the Fleet the Dice Game. Yeah.
That's pretty rare, isn't it?
I think so. I don't think, well, it's at least rare over here. There's not too many stores carry it, have it. I actually grabbed it secondhand off the marketplace, and it was a Kickstarter edition and everything. So I'm pretty chuffed with myself for finding that one, actually.
So your thing is fishing, which.
You know, I'm not a fisherman. I'm not, you know, I don't go fishing, and I'm not like super into fishing or anything, but I think it's like a pretty cool, unique theme. It's something that's different. I do like fish and chips. I do like eating. Come on, Adrian, I like eating anything. So what about you, Dwayne? Can you think of any unique individual themes? We're going to put you can't say Union Stockyards.
I can't say Union Stockyards. That's a unique thing that I really like. Yeah. But yeah, no, I wouldn't. I do like that. But I kind of like farming is not a unique theme, but unique farming themes about some particular spot in the world. Like lowlands where you got the sheep and you're trying to get the dikes and, you know, based on northern Germany there. And, what was another one I was trying to think of? It slipped my mind.
Maybe I'll have to come back to you when you think about it. What about you, Def?
I was going to say historic games. That's not unique. So I'm starting to think now that I could drill it down to some specific historic conflict. It would have to be World War II, but otherwise I would go with space exploration. It just, you know, gives me that bigger than humanity kind of feeling, which I love.
And I think if we throw over to Adrian, are you going to tell us serial killers using polyomino shapes to hide the bodies in your basement?
No, I haven't finished that game yet. That's on my playtest list. I tell you what, like, I really like CO2, Second Chance. Like, I think like energy, like sustainability, and all those kind of things. They're not as widely played as, you know, the big ones, the fantasies and the Vikings and space opera-y type, you know, fighting, you know, TI type things. So I really dig those. I think they're a really good theme. And I think CO2 Second Chance is a fantastic game. And I think that's a good way to go with energy and I'm looking for the word and it's absolutely eluding me. What's the word? God damn it. You know, just being globally aware, like environmentally friendly, that kind of a thing. I think that's a really cool unique theme. And that's in a very quite complex, heavy game. And it works really well. And the theme ties really well to the mechanics. So I think that's a really good one. And also Whistle Mountain. I think that's a really unique theme that's different. So. And you've got one there, Dwayne?
Yeah, I remembered. No. It's the game I was trying to think of, not agriculture, but Tinner's Trail.
Oh, yes.
Just that's a really unique. I mean, some place in history where people did something to survive that's, you know, not common is just fascinating to learn about. Just learn about how people survived and lived.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's some good answers to start with, but as always, this is about the answers from the community. So we will throw it over to you guys. Check out our Discord's server and our Facebook community if you want to participate in answering the question of the pod in what is your favorite unique theme or setting. And on that point, I will say thank you to all of our Patreon members who support us every month and without whom we would have a much more difficult time doing what we do every week. But it's not just those who support us on Patreon. It's everyone who contributes to our community, be it on Facebook or on Discord, or who attends our game days. Speaking of game days, we have the next game day coming up on the 5th of November in Brisbane. Tickets are still available right now. So if you live in or around Brisbane, or if you would like to travel to Brisbane, by all means, jump onto our Eventbrite page and purchase your ticket there. They are selling fast, so don't leave it too long. And following up from that, we will have the next Sydney Game Day, which I think this is the first time we've actually announced this publicly, but the next Sydney Game Day will be held on November 26th in the Castle RSL. Those tickets are also available now on Eventbrite page. Get along to all those things and support us, if you wouldn't mind, in any way you can, which could even be as simple as popping in saying g'day and putting a review on Apple Podcasts, where if you give us a 5-star review, Dan will read it out when he's next on the pod. So make it as difficult as possible so we can all laugh at him when he tries. And with that, we will move on to our final segment of today, which will be swearing an oath. Okay, so swear an oath segment. As always, we're going to go around the room and see who has completed their oath. Dwayne has opted to just sit here and poke fun at us and laugh about those of us who haven't completed Erosion the last time. So feel free to chip in with any shade throwing or whatever you like, Dwayne. But I'm going to go first to Adrian to say, what was your last oath, Adrian, and have you completed it?
Well, I spoiled it at the start. It was to teach Pampero at PAX, which I did a couple of times. Really enjoyed it. It's a great game. Can't wait to play it more. Sweet as. And my next oath actually kind of lines up with what we were talking about before, Mitch, and you mentioned the Cave Paintings expansion. And that's the one that interested me the most. Mm-hmm. So that was the one that I actually had already written on the run sheet before we started tonight. So I'm going to stick with that, and I'm going
right.
to add the Cave Paintings expansion to Endless Winter and see what I think about it, because it really does look interesting and it looks really different. So and it gives me that Coloma
definitely.
Vibes. You know how you go around the track in Coloma and you visit the different locations? The Cave Painting is almost like that Coloma map, how you link places together. So
yeah, right, that
kind
okay.
of a vibe. So
you mean with your wagon in Coloma?
Yeah, and it's Johnny yeah, right. Pack's expansion, so maybe it's a bit of a shared mechanic. So we'll see.
You mean he just plagiarized himself?
I think that's legally okay.
Have you met Johnny Pack, Dwayne?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, right. Because he's a big. I think he's based in
California.
He's in California, but he's in the mountain region or something.
Yeah, I think
he's
so.
A big. I thought he was into big Western sort of style games and things as well. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I played Coloma. Coloma, is that how you say
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
I owned it and sold it, so I didn't enjoy it enough to keep it. But it was enough. All right.
No worries. All right, Def. How about you, mate? What did you have as your oath, and did you complete it?
Well, I've got a couple that are kind of ongoing. One is to finish the Undaunted North Africa campaign with you, Mitch. So,
yeah, moving on. Let's not talk about that.
Yeah. Moving on from that. The other one was to play ISS Vanguard, which arrived in the meantime. And actually, this was meant to be my sizzling game of today, so we're going to have to
postpone that till next time.
Postpone that till next time, but I've binged through it. The last couple of weeks, played it seven, eight missions so far, and it's been great. But I'll talk about it when we sizzle the game next episodes. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of a next oath, I still haven't done the On Mars expansion with Adrian, so we still need to do that. But given that's been around for some time. I'm going to swear an oath to play a game I just got secondhand a couple of days ago. It's the last Mind Clash game I did not have, and that is Cerebria.
Oh, so
I know you've tried that, Mitch, and
I didn't get through it. Well, it's an interesting one. I've still got it on my shelf because I still have it because I think I played it solo. I tried to play it solo.
Yeah,
and It beat me. The solo, the AI rules and what you needed to do in order to play the other opponent in that
you
game.
Gave up.
I tapped out. I had a couple of turns and I was like, this is too much for me. It's taken me 35 minutes to play the AI turn and it's taking me 2 minutes to play my turn.
You're playing coin games now, mate. You can play anything. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, well, it was just a struggle. It was for me. And like, this is all for me. Other people might love it and I'd take nothing away from anybody else who enjoys the game. I'm not trying to do that.
We'll see how we go.
So yeah, I'll be interested to see if you can, you delve into those old, you know, a lot heavier games more than I do. So I'm interested to see what you think of it. I've kept the game because I, you know, from reading the rule book and understanding how the game plays, I think as a multiplayer game it will be phenomenal.
Okay.
So I'm holding on to hope that I can get a group together at some point that are keen to get it to the table and have a go because I want to play it too. So I'll be interested to see how your oath goes on that one.
Yeah, I'll let you know.
Cool. And that leaves me to do my oath. So my oath, I failed in my oath from the last time, which was to teach Cuba Libre at PAX to the rest of the Board Game BBQ crew. And I'm going to do what we usually do, and I'm going to blame them for it, not me. because I took the game. It was ready to be played, but we didn't get around to doing it. It was just so hectic and busy. at the convention. So it wasn't, it just didn't produce an opportunity to get it to the table. And
that
to get
might
it
have been one of the most
too much other stuff.
Over like thought.
Ambitious oaths
of all time, like bringing that thing to PAX where it's like playing games for like 15 hours a day and then trying to have like a power nap to go back the next day and try to play that game.
Yeah, maybe I should have realized that was
a bad idea.
Yeah, that was probably never going to happen. I should have seen that. But anyway, so the funny thing is with that oath, I'll have to put that on the shelf until next year PAX because obviously I can't teach it at PAX again next week. So that'll go into the archives to be brought out again later. In terms of what my next oath is going to be, I'm gonna go with two oaths. One because I didn't achieve my last one, but also because I kind of the first one's a little bit cheaty. The first one is going to be to actually get to play Fire in the Lake, because as I said earlier, I got it all out and got ready to play and haven't actually taken my first turn yet. It's literally still sitting here on the desk next to me. So I will achieve that. I'm also going to put the Fleet the Card Game onto my list of playing because, as I said, I picked that up during the week and I'm really keen to have a go at that. And I believe there's a really good I can't think of the word at the moment, iteration. There's a really good version of it up on VGA to play. So I should be able to get that one done without too much trouble. Just got to find a few people that are interested to come along and learn how it plays as well. So that's my oath done. So that brings us to the end of the show today. So before we close, I'd just like to say thanks so much to Dwayne Wolf for coming along and talking to us today about his new game, Union Stockyards. It should be coming out soon when they complete their production run. Thanks, Dwayne.
You bet. It's been great. Thanks, Mitch.
Thanks,
buddy. I'm surprised. Based on this podcast and your Take Charge personality, I can't believe you're the one that didn't complete your oath.
It's a facade.
That's all not just the real Mitch today.
I did actually get voted once, Dwayne, as the most, what was it, Adrian, the most intimidating member of our podcast. So maybe that's how I roll. I just intimidate people and they leave me alone when I don't achieve my successes. thanks also to Def and Adrian for coming along. It's always a pleasure with you two gentlemen.
No dramas. Pleasure, mate. Right. Thanks, Dwayne, for joining us. It was good talking to you.
Very looking forward to getting my...
See you in Australia sometime.
Looking forward to getting my copy of Union Stockyard. It's a game that I've spoken about a few times on here, and looking forward to giving it a try. So,
thank you. All right, thanks again, everybody, and we'll talk to you again next time. Bye.
Cheers.
Bye.